You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
It's the cup of life, we answer, a cup of blessings overflowing, a cup of water to quench our spirit's thirst, a cup of wine for celebration and dedication, the flame of truth, the flame of purification, oil for anointing, healing. Out of chaos, fear and horror, thus was the symbol crafted a generation ago. So may it be for us in these days of uncertainty, sorrow and rage, and a light to warm our souls and guide us home. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship, and especially warm welcome to those we haven't seen for a while. My name is Jenny Dyster, lay leader of this church. I welcome you here to the church that's been going since 1854. It's a long time. The land we meet on today is the traditional land of the Kaurna people. We respect and bless their spiritual relationship with country and their elders, past and present. Our church is a spiritual community that has principles rather than a creed, and is one that supports you in seeking and following your own spiritual path. Our current members include Christians, ex-Muslims, ex-Christians, Muslims, Jews, Baha'i, straights and gays. Your ethnic background, your gender identity and preference is respected here. We don't like, don't ask, don't tell. Be as open or as discreet as you feel inclined to be. After the service today, we will grab a quick coffee or tea and then have our AGM. If you're not a financial member, you are very welcome to attend. You can't vote, but you're very welcome to be here. I guess you didn't need a slide to recognise Finlandia. It's one of the hymns I really miss singing at church, but that was an absolutely beautiful rendition. Our topic today is democracy. E.M. Forster wrote a series of essays that he called Two Cheers for Democracy. And if you look at the map there, you can picture which parts of the world in dark blue the two cheers are for. Especially. Some democratic nations aren't very democratic. Now, my friend Gunhild has two boys, now grown, with their own families, and when their kids were small, they occasionally challenged Gun's authority by invoking the idea of democracy. Now, freedom is an intoxicating concept for a child. Responsibility, by contrast, is altogether too dull and worthy. But they would run a debate with Gunhild over issues, and Gunhild would occasionally run out of patience before they did, and she'd employ a conversation finisher. Yes, she'd snap, it is a democracy and I run it. Now, how do you explain democracy to a child? A government run by the people doesn't work as a standalone. You need to provide a contrast. Kings and queens in the olden days would tell everybody what to do, how much tax to pay, who to fight, who to be friends with. You'd probably have to explain that nowadays elected governments rule and royal families just do the ceremonial stuff usually, like opening parliament and welcoming leaders from other countries. Apart from monarchies, we can have oligarchies, rich men running countries, or the military, the army, or a dictator, or we can have a one-party state where that party outlaws all the other parties. Now, a smarty-pants kid might at this point conclude that Australia is not a democracy because Scott Morrison runs the country. Do not clutch the doorframe gasping for air. It's your big opportunity to explain representative democracy and the role of the opposition. And thank goodness we've packed the kids off to Sunday Club, so we're not going there. You can relax. I'm sure, though, like me, you grew up equating democracy with voting, free and fair elections. So what's the catch? Wind me up and set me loose. Political parties have no constitutional place in Parliament, but they have become central to it in practice. In Australia, no party outside the main two has ever formed government. Even when combined, the minority parties have never received as much as 30% of the vote. The primary vote, that is. The vast majority of successful candidates are pre-selected and supported by either the coalition or Labor parties, campaigning on their respective national platforms. Once in Canberra, they vote along party lines, giving primary allegiance to their political group, not their constituency. So it's possible for a government to send us to war, ignore climate change, fail to provide social housing. There's not much we can do about it. There is something pat and predetermined about the way politicians will respond to material that comes before them that makes the whole process seem farcical. Televised question time reveals a lot of ritual performance. Party politicians do not need to listen, reflect, or change their minds. Age does not weary them, but the years sure do condemn. It is a common belief among the elites of most democracies that ordinary people are either disengaged or apathetic about politics or so ignorant about how it works that they shouldn't be allowed anywhere near the levers of power. This echoes Plato's concern about mob rule. And indeed today, conservative commentators will opine that democracies fail when we're too democratic. This kind of contempt becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. When people can vote only every 3 or 4 years, and when their opinions are aggregated into sound bites, and citizen participation is made difficult or uncomfortable, they will turn to social media. The unregulated exchanges are unedifying, to say the least, and politicians will use this as evidence of the stupidity of the general public. So, having accused us of being disengaged, these elites hold up our actual engagement via social media or talkback radio as an excuse for exclusion. It's as if I called you useless for not being able to drive a car and never gave you any driving lessons. Well, why should we care? For one thing, it's dangerous. When people who are used to wielding power observe the mayhem caused by frustration, they want to pass laws further curtailing liberty, and the heat in the kitchen goes up. It is not acceptable that Daniel Andrews has received death threats. Imre Pelivar urged protesters to bring guns to the freedom rallies and allegedly supplied Molotov cocktails and other explosive devices. The huge freedom rallies and the fact that Craig Kelly's party has more members than either the Labor Party or the Coalition does not make me feel confident about governance in Australia. So that's one reason for caring. The other one is our fifth principle. It directs us to uphold the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. When you look at people like this, you may feel your grip on Unitarian principles faltering, particularly the first principle, which refers to the inherent dignity of all people. But fear not, I'm here to help. The cause is a decline in democracy. These people are a symptom. They're not the cause. The Economist Intelligence Unit publishes an annual survey. It rates state of democracy across 167 countries based on five measures: electoral process and pluralism, that's how the elections are held and multi-party, the functioning of government, political participation, democratic political culture and civil liberties. And it finds that only 8.4% of the world live under a full democracy, while more than a third live under authoritarian rule. The global score of less than 5.5 out of 10 is the lowest recorded since the index began in 2006. Before the pandemic really bit in, this is what the top table looked like. You'll see America's not there. America had been missing since 2016. Now, the pandemic put a stop to rising levels of political engagement in America. Turnout in the American presidential election in November was the highest for 120 years. The country recorded its best political participation score since the index began. But public trust in the democratic process was dealt a blow by the refusal of Donald Trump and his followers to accept the election result. And the United States therefore remains in the flawed democracy category. I have an article entitled Flawed Democracy, published in February 21, and I quote, "Government-imposed lockdowns and other pandemic control measures led to a huge rollback of civil liberties in 2020, causing downgrades across the majority of countries. Confronted by a new and deadly disease to which humans had no natural immunity, most people concluded that preventing a catastrophic loss of life justified some temporary loss of freedom. The ranking penalised countries that withdrew civil liberties, failed to allow proper scrutiny of emergency powers, or denied freedom of expression, regardless of whether there was public support for the government measures. In France, for example, severe lockdowns and national curfews led to a small but significant decrease in its overall score, and the country dropped into the flawed democracy category. So did Australia. Problems with democracy predate COVID, though. COVID turbocharges the issues. What can be done? Well, let's start by looking at elections. Australia's got a huge number of safe seats, meaning that parties can ignore the safe seats and focus on the marginals. The last election bears this out. The coalition was returned to government with two-seat majority. The key to that victory was the promise of jobs that would be created by the coalition's approval of Australia's largest ever coal mine. The coalition rightly bet that poor climate change policy would not cost it any seats, but a new mine might win it some. With a voice effectively only given to voters every 3 or 4 years, and only the voters in marginal seats, there should be little surprise at the rise of feelings of discontent and disenfranchisement. Increasingly, groups are turning to protest and non-violent direct action. I think it's time to challenge the idea that you've really got to vote for a major party because the others have got no hope of getting in, and besides, they have the luxury of being reactive or niche in their policies. Well, it so happens that many of the countries that rated higher than us in the democracy table, like the Scandinavian countries and Germany and so on, they're all formed from coalitions and alliances. And when you have a smattering of smaller parties and you've got to make an alliance, politicians can't afford to be as rude and dismissive of anyone not in their party. Now, I'm sure you know about direct democracy from ancient Greece. In a direct democracy, such as ancient Greece, all citizens, not women, slaves or plebs, because they don't count, all citizens are invited to participate in all political decisions. In this form of democracy, citizens are continuously involved in the exercise of power and decisions by majority rule. Well, obviously you can't do that in a modern nation state, but there are variations that are practicable. A form of direct democracy can be incorporated into an existing system, as a complement, not a replacement. There are many models used around the world. Switzerland, for example, citizens vote on a broad range of issues up to four times a year. California, admittedly, is just on a state level. They've got a system. In Rojava, in Syrian Kurdistan, an experimental in grassroots direct democracy is underway. You may know that the climate change action group Extinction Rebellion is calling for a citizens' assembly to be established, and that's what they mean, a bit of direct democracy. The current model of representative democracy in Australia is failing to hold the government to account. If a citizen's voice is reduced to one that's rarely heard, then Australia is not living up to its democratic potential. The country risks exposing itself to increasingly extreme measures from the disenfranchised who refuse to be silenced. In his book, The Future of Everything, Big Audacious Ideas for a Better World, the author Tim Dunlop examines big technology shifts reshaping the world, and he considers how to use the shifts to create a better quality of life for all. He also explores how the media, wealth creation, work, education, and how the way we are governed could be transformed. If we want to fix the way that governments work, the first thing we should do is replace voting with sortition in at least some governing bodies. Sortition means to choose, to sort, by the use of lots, that is, by random sample, like the method we use to choose jurors for a court case. Instead of voting for members of parliament, we should choose at least some of them randomly. It's the most straightforward way of enabling ordinary citizens to participate in the running of their country. But the effect it would have on politics and government could be transformative. Now, if that idea seems too out there, we'll need to come up with some way of attacking the chief threats to democracy. The first necessary shift is a radical reform of campaign finance, that's political funding. The power of money in politics poisons everything. George Monbiot is a British writer and an activist who writes for The Guardian and other high-level publications. His proposal for reforming campaign finance is brutally simple. Every party would be entitled to charge the same fee for membership, $50, $100, whatever. This would then be matched by the state with a fixed multiple. Any other political funding, direct or indirect, would be illegal. That, of course, would force parties to re-engage with voters. Now, of course, this idea would be resisted by our major parties, which means if we don't press for some form of direct democracy or alternatively embark on a massive media campaign, it won't happen. Both parties are wedded to donations. The threats to democracy are identity, inequality, interference, and information. Now, compared to the United States of America or Myanmar, say, identity politics is pretty minor in Australia. Inequality, well, it's a bit more of a concern. If you just think about people who don't have access to digital technology, how their lives are affected. Dreadful, really. I mean, I recently just took me about an hour and a half, but I managed to get my vaccination certificate on the phone. It was not easy. I swear, you need a higher degree to be able to do it. Or an 11-year-old. Now, information. Well, we've got Sky News, Murdoch Press and Facebook ramping up conspiracy theories, anti-vaxxers, climate deniers, Holocaust deniers. It is a problem. But that media is not necessarily swamping the reputable sources, and we do have some very good sources for information. That leaves interference. That is the biggest threat to our democracy, and that interference is to do with money. Donations, contracts, deals. In early 2020, the Nationals Party Deputy Minister for Sport, Bridget McKenzie, had to resign for breaching ministerial standards over the so-called sports rorts affair. 70% of the grants were allocated against the advice of Sport Australia. 41 million went to marginal seats. 18 months later, she's back on the front bench. Different portfolio. You see what I mean about people not being actually accountable to the people? They're just, it's just sorted out at a party level. Despite constitutional intentions, in Australia, elected members are putting the re-election of their political party ahead of their own constituents. And added to that, not all constituencies are being treated equally. If we look at the democracy on a micro scale rather than a macro, the problems are a lot easier to address. Donations, for example. When our previous minister started to worry that a few rather hefty gifts could have strings attached, he suggested setting up a gift register. Well, we don't have two gangs on the Committee of Management fighting it out for campaign funds. Just sail through. We have a gift register. But even organisations with memberships that are small, maybe 10 to 100 people, if you have the same people in charge, it leads those people having more say and it leaves those who aren't in charge feeling as if they need to be seen and not heard. You become an incumbent and you get weightier and weightier as time goes on. Years ago, I directed the open air nativity at Stirling. After the first year, I realised there were things I wanted to change. When shepherds wash their socks by night has far too many verses, especially when everyone has sung at the same volume, and with no variation in the tune. I wanted to vary the carols. I wanted a bit of rutter instead of once in Royal David's City every year. Good news for modern man might be an evangelical's dream of a Bible, but it's not mine. Doesn't have the poetry of the King James. The Nativity Committee had been in situ for 30 years. They moaned a lot about the next generation not being prepared to step up. They were getting old. They wanted some young ones. In my late 40s, I counted as young. But despite saying nothing at all in my first year, I just observed, and in the second year being really tentative about my requests, and I was only firm in the third year, not a single change was approved. I resigned. We have a few advantages over that committee. We rotate officers and members, so dynasties don't evolve. And people can't get away with the line, but it's always been. So change happens. We listened when Alex and the younger committee members said that young people don't carry cash these days. Even if we were still carrying cash ourselves, we listened, so we got a cash point. When Rob wanted a screen, because people are more visual, got one. And then the changes that come from that, that meant we weren't wedded to the green hymnal, more modern songs could be put up, and it was easier and easier to avoid the dated rewrites of traditional hymns. Now, our Committee of Management has developed good protocols for sharing airtime and civil discourse. People don't speak at length or repetitively during meetings because we share information via email and digest it beforehand. The meetings are held in the hour before church. If you think things through yourself, it's easier to listen and process other people's ideas before voting, and that's the culture of our comm. Being the lay leader rather than the chair in Committee of Management meetings has given me more time to observe. I don't vote now. Committee of Management meetings are open to church members. You can attend, you can't vote. We don't have branch stacking. As a visitor, you might even be invited to speak, especially if you've let the chairperson know that you would like to speak on a particular issue. Members can read a précis of the meeting in the newsletter or request a complete copy from the administrative secretary. In other words, decisions are not being made behind closed doors. Since I've been in the church, the constitution has been altered in response to changing circumstances and for the purposes of clarity. Some alterations have unforeseen consequences, and that's where retweaking comes in. But constitutional changes can't be snuck in with a quick motion at an AGM. Instead, notice is given at the AGM that there will be a special general meeting within the next 3 months. And 3 weeks before that meeting, the exact wording of the suggested changes is provided for everybody to read and digest before the meeting. It's good to see that we have nominations for our rotating positions and that we've got a good turnout this Sunday for our AGM. No democracy sausage, I'm afraid. We will keep our coffee break short so we can begin our meeting on time and you can find a healthier alternative for lunch. This is an independent and self-governed church, so it cannot live on fresh air alone. It depends for its survival on your generosity. If you don't make an annual contribution or use direct transfer, the facilities are in the foyer, the cash point, and the grey chalice for cash. Could you stand for the benediction today? My friends, there is a power at work in the universe. It works through human hands, but it was not made by human hands. It is a creative, sustaining, and transforming power, and we can trust that power with our lives. It will sustain us whenever we take a stand on the side of love, whenever we take a stand for peace and justice, whenever we take a risk. Trust in that power. We are together, held by that power. Those were the words of Tom Sharder.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.